Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we kicked off a series we're calling The Secret Lives of CEOs, in which we've been interviewing management scholars and a bunch of high-profile CEOs. We began by trying to figure out what makes a successful CEO successful. This week, what happens when the CEO chair is suddenly empty and you've got to fill it? Also, we'll speak with Indra Nooyi, the CEO of PepsiCo, on how to deal with activist investors who want you to split up the company.
At the end of the day, we viewed him as a free consulting. Painful, but free consulting.
On how hard it can be to make your company change with the times.
You know, when people say culture eats strategy, I lived it firsthand.
And what happens when the CEO, especially the female CEO, goes home at night?
Don't try to pretend that you're still the big boss, because you're not.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Where do CEOs come from? First of all, keep in mind that small firms vastly outnumber large ones.
When people mention CEO, they think of an older white man in charge of a company of 10,000 people.
That's the Stanford economist, Nicholas Bloom.
In fact, there are 6 million companies in America. The median company, so the 50th percentile, has 3 employees, and the most common company has 1.
But let's say we are talking about a big company. Maybe it's a startup like Facebook or Uber that shot into the stratosphere. Maybe it's an old-timer like General Electric or PepsiCo. Where does the ideal CEO come from? Is it an insider who knows the culture, who's got institutional memory, or an outsider with fresh eyes and instincts? To what degree and on which dimensions should the incoming CEO resemble the outgoing one? Let's start this conversation with Jack Welch, who became CEO of GE after 20 years at the company. You were ultimately appointed CEO by Reg Jones. You were very different from him. He was kind of buttoned down, formal, classically trained in a way, and British, and you were more scrappy, Boston area, said what you thought, didn't necessarily care that much how people received it. It was a fascinating handoff from him to you, and it's amazing that he saw in you, what others may not have seen. I'm curious. You were there a long time before that day. I wonder how much you were motivated to stay and rise by your desire to change the way the company was run, because you and he both acknowledged that at the time you took over, GE needed a lot of change.
Yeah, I had an enormous thirst to get my hands on it. And so obviously I was on the sidelines thinking what I would do if I got it. And when I got it, I did it.
You make it sound pretty easy.
Well, frankly, it's a lot easier to come up in a company and see its foibles from the bottom through the middle than be brought in as a hero at the top and know nothing of the infrastructure or the vibes of the place.
Welch eliminated many of GE's business units, and he let go so many employees that he came to be known as Neutron Jack. Doing so, he argued, was how GE was going to win, and it didn't help any employee to pretend that they were better than they were.
It's a sin if people come to work not knowing where they stand. Everybody who works for you must know where they stand, what their boss thinks about them, what the company thinks about them. This idea of false kindness is pure nonsense. Pure nonsense.
Jack Welch was not everyone's favorite flavor. Some said he was abrasive, that his cost-cutting was inhumane. Others said he got lucky, turning GE into more of a finance company during what turned out to be a huge stock market run-up. Whatever the case, his tenure as CEO, from a performance perspective, was extraordinary.
We were doing $26 billion in sales, with $1.4 billion of profit. And we had 420,000 employees. Okay, that was the early 1980s. 20 years later, we were doing $150 billion in sales, plus or minus. And we were making $15 billion. And we had 300,000 employees instead of 420. So either we were fat before and we needed to move, or something's different.
It's a sample set of exactly one, but Jack Welch is evidence that it's possible for an insider to take over and kickstart a legacy firm. But what if GE had brought in an outsider? Maybe they would have done even better. For a firm in need of big change, you'd think that an external CEO might have all sorts of advantages, wouldn't you?
The truth is just the opposite. The research slightly favors the objective internal person to make the big changes.
That's Jeff Sonnenfeld from the Yale School of Management. He's been studying CEOs for 30 years.
They know where the problems are, where the bodies are buried. They also know where the opportunities are. An objective, smart, honest, intelligent insider is generally a much better pick than somebody from the outside.
Here are some numbers to back up what Sonnenfeld's saying. A 2009 academic study, which analyzed established public companies from 1986 to 2005, found that internally promoted CEOs led to at least a 25% better total financial performance than external hires. A 2010 study by Booz & Company similarly found that in 7 of the 10 previous years, insider CEOs delivered higher market returns than external hires. And yet, external hiring seems to be on the rise. In 2013, between 20 and 30% of boards replaced outgoing CEOs with external hires. A few decades ago, that number was only 8 to 10%. Outside hires also tend to be more expensive. Their median pay is $3 million more than for inside hires. So an external hire will, on average, cost you more and perform worse. And yet, that's the trend.
What has happened in this oh-so-troubling governance days of this new millennia is the insiders are often disparaged way too quickly, as boards have taken on with a messianic zeal a belief that whoever our savior is for the next CEO, it ought to be somebody from the outside. Because, hey, if this company's not performing perfectly, we can't take one of these knuckle-dragging drones from within to save us. With the outside, you have no idea if that person has gotten a lot of credit because of a biased relationship with the search firm, or maybe that person had been part of a successful operation in a strong-performing company and is benefiting from the afterglow of other people's work. Whereas in the inside, the person, you know when they've tripped. So often we give too much attention to mistakes from an insider. But an insider, we can judge how they've learned, how they've come back from setbacks and mistakes, and an insider tends to be a much better choice.
In 2014, Microsoft, one of the biggest companies in the world, found itself searching for a CEO. Steve Ballmer had announced he was stepping down. He'd been at Microsoft forever, the 30th employee hired, and he was just its second CEO after co-founder Bill Gates. A lot of names were mentioned as Microsoft searched for its next CEO. Many of them were high-profile outsiders. One name rarely mentioned was Satya Nadella. He was a relatively low-profile insider, a computer scientist who'd been at the firm since 1992. And yet, Nadella was the ultimate choice. You make no secret of it that a lot of people were hoping for an outsider to be appointed CEO of Microsoft, but you're a lifer. I gather there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm internally when you were named.
As you said, I'm a consummate insider, but the one thing that I've tried to do, being someone who's grown up in Microsoft, is have as objective an outside in view.
He was a very humble guy.
That, again, is CEO watcher Jeff Sonnenfeld.
He was never going for the bright lights and trumpets. There was no grandiosity about him. And he was quietly but prophetically building up the cloud business that wasn't, you know, Bill Gates or Steve Ballmer's front burner topic. And yet he saw what was coming. And as CEO, one of the things he's done is by increasing market cap since he's been in there in just, 3 years, just over 3 years, by $250 billion.
That $250 billion figure was accurate when we spoke with Sonnenfeld, but that was a few months back. As of today, Microsoft's market cap has increased by more than $400 billion since Nadella took over, its share price more than doubling.
But that tells only a small part of the story, because he did come into a culture that had become very bureaucratic. It had become possessed by very strong turf issues. And you might say, well, how did he do it? Just talking with insiders in there. There's an absolute genuine collaborative decision-making on anything large or small, that it isn't driven by fiefdoms, nothing by imperial decree. There's an accessibility and a friendliness, almost a playfulness that he's brought in to a company where you just wouldn't have thought it was possible at this life stage to do it. What he did to revive the culture is really incredible.
Nadella himself attributes his management success to one word.
Empathy.
He wasn't always so empathic.
I always ask myself, you know, at 25, when I was interviewing and somebody says, what would you do if you see a baby on the street crying and after having fallen down? I answered with, you know, thinking this is some trick question. Maybe there's some algorithm that I'm missing, and said, I'll call 911, only to have that manager get up and walk me out of the room saying, you know, that's the absolute answer. And if you see a baby falling down, you pick them up and hug them. And I was devastated because I remember thinking about it. And I say, how could I not get that?
By Nadella's own admission, it took an even more dramatic event for him to get it.
On the 13th of August in 1996 at 11:29, all our life changed.
His wife, Anu, an architect, had just given birth to their first child, Zane. He had a severe case of cerebral palsy.
It took me multiple years to even understand what had happened, because in some sense, I was more about, like, why did this happen to us? What happened to me? And it's only by observing my wife, really step up, give up her career, and do all things she was doing to care for Zane, that's when I realized nothing happened to me. In fact, really something has happened to my son, and it's time for me to step up and see life through his eyes and do what I should do as a parent and as a father. So that's, I think, perhaps the biggest lesson for me around empathy. And it's only developed through your life's experience. It's not something that's really endowed on you. But as long as, with every passing year, with perhaps every passing mistake you make, you develop more of a sense of being able to see life through other people's eyes, is going to make you more effective parent, more effective colleague, and a more effective partner.
So you can see why the Microsoft board was impressed enough with Nadella to make him CEO, despite being a relatively low-profile insider. And that choice, so far at least, has paid off. But the fact is that many, many CEO searches look for a very typical sort of candidate. I'd talked about this with the Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom.
By the time you get to people with basically, you know, great education, charming individuals, some kind of prior experience, they're all in the frame for leadership.
It sounds as though you're raising then a central problem or challenge, at least, which is if everybody's always looking for CEOs who fit the CEO mold, then you're going to continue recruiting and installing a bunch of well-educated white men from middle or upper middle class backgrounds, which is, you know, I think we'd all agree is A, potentially very discriminatory, but B, potentially idiotic, because you're reducing your pool of potentially excellent people. So how do you deal with that?
Imagine if you were making a new type of soup and you decided to invent tomato soup. There's already 100 different, you know, types of tomato soup out there. But if instead you went for something different, hedgehog and chili soup, you know, most people would think it's horrible. They'd never go near it. But, you know, 1 in 100 consumers would think that's kind of cool and try it out, and you'd have a market, much as it is with CEOs. You actually really want diversity, because you actually want to be different from your competitors. And that enables you to have the edge. It enables you to innovate. So sure, there's going to be a lot of, you know, white men CEOs, but given there's a lot of white men CEOs out there, actually, there'd be a lot of payoff to having, you know, something different, because you have a different angle and that's where you can make money in business.
Are we actually going to find that people are starting to hire people with different views and different backgrounds and different experiences who we really believe are going to change the system and not just perpetuate it with different players?
That's Ellen Powell.
I am the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at the KPOR Center and a venture partner at KPOR Capital. And I'm also CEO and co-founder of Project Include, a nonprofit oriented towards giving everyone a fair chance to succeed in tech.
Powell herself had a brief and stormy tenure as CEO, interim CEO technically, at Reddit. Some of the changes she made deeply upset the Reddit community.
At the end of the day, I think the board, you know, didn't have the stomach for it. And, you know, they told me that they wanted me to reach, you know, either 350 million or 500 million users by the end of the year. And I just said, you know, like, no company has done that. So that, you know, I can't commit to doing that. And that ended up being the reason why they asked me to leave.
From her experience within firms and as a venture capitalist, Powell has found that the CEO playing field is quite unlevel, tilted especially against women.
There's a perception that if you are pregnant, that you're no longer as good of a founder or as committed of a CEO. And we've seen story after story. I don't think there's any scientific research about it, but of, you know, CEOs hiding their pregnancies because they don't want to be perceived as less of an employee or less of a leader. And, you know, I had a coworker who, I think she tried to hide her pregnancy for like 5 months.
We will look more closely at gender and leadership in an upcoming show about what's called The Glass Cliff. It'll feature Carol Bartz, the former CEO of Yahoo and Autodesk. When Bartz started out as a computer scientist in the 1970s, there were few women in the field.
The guys that I worked with called me Carl because they didn't want their wives to know they were traveling with a female.
When Bartz took over Yahoo in 2009, the company was in a lot of trouble. She only lasted 2.5 years.
Well, I was in a limo driving into New York City when I got a call from Roy Bostock, the chairman of the board, and told me I was fired. I was literally 20 minutes away from where he was physically located. He didn't have the nerve to see me face to face. I do not believe that that would have happened to a man. He didn't have the nerve. Now, I like to think he didn't have the nerve because he knew I would have probably punched him out. But
and was he right?
Might be right. I don't know.
Why did Carol Bartz, with such an excellent track record as CEO of Autodesk, fail as CEO at Yahoo? Is it because she was an outsider? Was it a strategic issue? A personality issue? Maybe a timing issue? Or maybe Carol Bartz's failure had nothing to do with Carol Bartz. Maybe Yahoo was just a company being blown sideways in a tech tornado where display ads were cratering and Google was killing everybody else in search. Bartz's successors didn't have a very good time either. Yahoo was at one point the world's most popular web destination, with a market cap of more than $110 billion. In 2016, it was sold to Verizon for just $4.5 billion. So maybe we should be cautious about ascribing too much blame or credit to a given CEO. There are a lot of factors to consider in any firm's success or failure, and there's a huge variance in the backgrounds and styles and skills of different CEOs. There seems to be no secret sauce whatsoever, unless maybe it's luck. That said, when it's time to pick a CEO, the numbers do seem to suggest that the best bet is a stable and experienced insider.
Even the day before they told me that I was going to be CEO, I didn't think that I was going to be CEO. So there wasn't a plan to become CEO. The plan was to just keep doing a very, very good job and, you know, focus on running the job that I had and making sure the company was in a good place. I think one thing just led to another.
Indra Nooyi of PepsiCo is easily the most experienced, stable insider we've run across in our reporting on CEOs.
At one point, she was chief administrative officer, chief financial officer, and chief operating officer, basically all at once, and then took on the tasks over Christmas at one point, become also chief technology officer. Indra is an unbelievably brilliant person.
So, coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, what's it like to take over a huge multinational food and beverage company just as the world decides that your food and beverages are a threat to humanity? And just as a global recession hits.
One had to learn in a hurry how to run this company through extreme periods of adversity. And there's no book you can read. You have to develop the book as you go along. And that's what was really, really, really tough.
That's right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, you. Yeah, I'm talking to you. You, for the purposes of this conversation, are on the board of directors of a large publicly traded firm, and you've just learned that your CEO will be stepping down. So, do you replace them with a company insider or an outsider? Boards are increasingly picking outsiders in the hope of shaking things up. You can't blame them. Just think of all the business school buzzwords about shifting the paradigm and thinking outside the box, pushing the envelope. But if what you really care about is the firm's success, rather than just ticking all the boxes on the buzzword menu, then you'll go with a stable and experienced insider. That's what the data show.
An objective, smart, honest, intelligent insider is generally a much better pick than somebody from the outside.
It's time now to hear from one such insider who's been phenomenally successful. She runs a huge and hugely visible company, a company whose products you've likely encountered in the last day or two, if not the last hour or two. And yet she herself isn't hugely visible, which seems to be just how she likes it. She's not flashy, just smart, reliable, forward-looking, and just about any other positive adjective you can come up with. If CEOs got reviews, like on Amazon, this one would have 5 stars. From people who shop for CEOs for a living, like David Rubenstein of the Carlyle Group.
I've known her for quite a while, and I think she's done a spectacular job.
From other members of the relatively tiny group of women who run big companies, like former tech CEO Carol Bartz.
Anytime we can put up someone like her, hold her up as an example of what females can do. And she did. She did things against the, I don't want to say advice, but against popular opinion. She's been very strong.
And from professional CEO watchers, like Jess Sonnenfeld of the Yale School of Management.
She wants to delegate authority for others to grow and allow them to make some mistakes that she knows she could have prevented. Indra doesn't want to tell you, but she generally is the smartest person in the room.
Indra Nooyi grew up in India and went to college and business school there. She played cricket and lead guitar in an all-girl rock band. In 1980, she came to the States and got a second master's degree at the Yale School of Management. She worked for several years in management consulting, then in corporate strategy, and joined PepsiCo in 1994 as chief strategist. 12 years later, she became its CEO and now oversees 260,000 global employees and a snack empire that includes Frito-Lay chips, Tropicana juices, Gatorade, Quaker Foods, and, of course, lots and lots of soda. We spoke with her not long ago on a Monday morning.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So let me ask you this. If we knew, let's say, 12-year-old Indra Nooyi in Madras, India, attending an all-girls Catholic convent school, how surprised would we be to know that today she's CEO of PepsiCo in Purchase, New York?
Probably incredulous, because what you would have assumed is that she was going to be a firebrand, she was going to do something that was non-conventional, but she was going to do it in India, you know, probably happily married with lots of little kids, taking care of all of the older people in the home, and just this little conservative girl around, but somebody who was going to be a firebrand and make trouble. CEO of PepsiCo in the United States of such a global company? Absolutely not.
Was there a turning point?
I think it's been a set of gradual moves. Even the day before they told me that I was going to be CEO, I didn't think that I was going to be CEO. So there wasn't a plan to become CEO. The plan was to just keep doing a very, very good job and making sure the company was in a good place. I think one thing just led to another.
You once said, when we become CEOs, they give us CEO pills, and that allows us to remain strong in the face of all this criticism. So what's the toughest thing either that you've gone through as CEO or on a kind of routine basis about being CEO of a company like PepsiCo?
You know, the biggest surprise in becoming CEO was that when you ascend to the number one job, you are it, as they say. When you're president of the company or CFO, you still have a very important job. But there's always a CEO out there who was on the front line, who was being focused on. And when you become CEO overnight, you are the person calling all the shots. You're responsible for making sure you get all the information from the company, crystallize it down to, you know, simple ideas, and then tell the organization what to do. And so it's a very daunting job to be a CEO. So day one, you have to be ready to take on the mantle of being CEO.
Nui was installed as president and CEO of PepsiCo in October of 2006 and became chairman in May of 2007. The timing turned out to be not so wonderful.
People talk about a honeymoon period, but there really isn't a honeymoon period because from day one, you are the CEO. And when I took on the CEO job, the world was a different place because a few months after I became CEO, there was a financial collapse. You know, the retail environment changed. The U.S. market slowed down. So one had to learn in a hurry how to run this company through extreme periods of adversity. And there's no book you can read. You have to develop the book as you go along. And that's what was really, really, really tough.
After you became CEO, you spent a lot of time and money essentially reformulating PepsiCo as a food and beverage company much more in line with modern ideas about nutrition. I'd like to speak about the upfront costs of that reformulation, including a dip in market share and some very unhappy shareholders.
I think as we looked at consumer trends and we looked at where we thought the markets were growing, we knew we had to retool our portfolio. That was just not even a question. We knew that if we didn't do it, our future was in jeopardy.
Did you feel at any point that PepsiCo might come to be seen as tobacco companies came to be seen, kind of peddling an indefensibly unhealthy product?
It was never that drastic. It was more, you know, consumer tastes change all the time. You know, they change in food and beverage faster than they change anywhere else. And this was a sea change that was happening because, you know, the whole society and their habits and their lifestyles were changing. So my point is, this is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity for us to change our portfolio, go where the consumer is going, and gain market share. But I was not, you know, stupid enough to say this can be done overnight. I mean, I knew this journey was going to be long, arduous, and was going to be filled with pitfalls because it's not just the desire to change the portfolio, but to line up the entire company's innovation, marketing, execution, and budgets to go where this marketplace was going. And then we had to change the culture of this company. You know, when people say culture eats strategy, I lived it firsthand because, you know, I saw how many people sort of said, why should we change our company that's been so successful for a future we don't quite understand? And so one had to paint the future in a very personal way. I mean, I had to use our own employees to say, look, your own eating and drinking habits are changing. If your eating and drinking habits are changing as evidenced by A, B, C, and D, which I was observing at work, why do you believe the rest of the consumers out there, their habits are not changing? So once you start to change the culture of the company, everything else happens fast. So I think this core culture change is what took so long? And through that process, obviously people were impatient because, you know, the way our whole investing works, it's, yeah, you need to make the strategic changes. Yes, we know that the marketplace is changing and you have to change, but you've got to do everything while delivering phenomenal returns in the short term. I mean, that's a tough one because change takes a little longer than investors expect.
You, like most big public companies, have dealt with activist shareholders. You seem to have taken mostly a firm line with them, including Nelson Peltz, who wanted you to spin off Frito-Lay. He eventually exited his position in PepsiCo with a pretty nice profit. I'm curious what you did to celebrate when Nelson Peltz exited that position.
You know, believe me, and this might sound incredulous, but we didn't celebrate when he came in. We didn't celebrate when he left. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're all activists inside the company. I mean, I own almost 50 times my salary in PepsiCo stock. My entire net worth is tied up in PepsiCo. And if somebody as an activist came into the company and suggested we do things differently, we study every idea very, very carefully. Because if they have an idea for us to run the company better than we are, we will incorporate it. But if their idea has more risks than upsides, then we have to worry about the company. So at the end of the day, we are maniacally focused on the success of PepsiCo and our shareholders. And we're not just listening to ideas. We think about the implementation. And so when Nelson Peltz came in, believe me, when he presented his white paper to us, we studied every chart, every idea, and had multiple conversations with him because at the end of the day, we viewed him as a free consulting. Painful, but free consulting. So there were a lot of little operational things that Nelson opened our eyes to. And I'd say at the end of the day, any activist who's been in PepsiCo stock will tell you that we treated them with great respect. We listened to them. We took in whatever we thought made sense. And where we thought our strategy was in a better place, we stayed firm.
Until the early 1990s, PepsiCo was mostly about selling soda and salty snacks. Then it began to diversify. Under Nui, the company now groups its products into three categories: fun for you, better for you, and good for you. Good for you products include fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and so on, with an emphasis on less sugar and fat. This category includes brands like Tropicana, Quaker, and Aquafina, which is water. Better for you includes lower calorie sodas and baked potato chips. And fun for you, well, those are the brands you're probably most familiar with: Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Lay's, and Cheetos. I understand that men and women eat chips very differently. Can you tell us the differences?
I think, you know, when you eat out of a flex bag, you know, one of our single serve bags, especially as you watch a lot of the young guys eat the chips, they love their Doritos and, you know, they lick their fingers with great glee. And when they reach the bottom of the bag, they pour the little broken pieces into their mouth. Because they don't want to lose that taste of the flavor and the broken chips in the bottom. You know, women, I think, would love to do the same, but they don't. They don't like to crunch too loudly in public. And, you know, they don't lick their fingers generously. And they don't like to pour the little broken pieces and the flavor into their mouth.
So is there like a male and female version of chips that you're playing with or no?
It's not a male and female as much as, are there snacks for women that can be designed and packaged differently? And yes, we are looking at it, and we're getting ready to launch a bunch of them soon. For women, you know, low crunch, the full taste profile, you know, not have so much of the flavor stick on the fingers. And how can you put it in your purse? Because women love to carry a snack in their purse. The whole design capability we built in PepsiCo was to allow design to work with innovation, not just on packaging colors, but to go through the entire cycle and say all the way to the product in the pantry or how it's being carried around or how they eat it in the car or drink it in the car, what should be the design of the product, the package, the experience, so that we can influence the entire chain.
If this exchange sounded familiar to you, that may be because shortly after we spoke with Nui and published her interview on the Freakonomics Radio podcast, her answer about gendered chip eating went viral. A British tabloid twisted her words and launched a phenomenon that became known by the hashtag Lady Doritos. The internet ate it up. Nui was accused of sexism and tone deafness. Can you imagine that? A tabloid newspaper and the internet creating a fake scandal? In any case, let's remember that Nui is considered one of the most highly regarded CEOs on the planet. You are known for being really involved down to the micro level on how the product is in stores and so on.
So I want to be clear on one thing. Our business leaders all run their own businesses. I don't run their businesses. But what I do is I'm constantly out there in the marketplace looking to see how our products look on the shelf. And then I come back and I talk to my people about what I saw was good and what wasn't really good to push them to higher levels of performance, especially versus competition. We have to look at the product all the way to the retail shelf, maybe sometimes to the consumer's pantry at home. And that's what caused us to even do home visits at times, to really figure out how the consumer stocked the product. Is our package size right? Is it suitable to the refrigerator sizes that people have in their homes in various countries?
I'd like to talk to you about the scientific thrust of the firm. You've got a science background yourself. You hired Derek Yock, a former World Health Organization official, to develop your dietary guidelines. So I'd love you to talk about the kind of interface between the scientific method that you grew up as a student appreciating and how that's incorporated into a modern food and beverage company.
You know, one of the things that my experience has taught me is that if you were trained as a scientist in your, you know, youth, through your high school and college, if you stay with the STEM disciplines, you can learn pretty much all of the subjects as you move along in life. And your scientific disciplines play a very important role and ground you very well as you move into positions of higher and higher authority, whatever the job is. It's very hard to learn science later on in life. So one of the pleas I would have for most young people today is stay with STEM as long as you can. Now let me get to the question that you asked. I think one of the big things we realized in PepsiCo is that we were very good at line extensions of our products. We had more development in PepsiCo than we had research. So we could do flavor extensions of our products. Occasionally we could buy and build on a new product. But we were not very good at meaningful innovation or meaningful package transformation or meaningful ingredient development that could in fact apply to multiple products. We knew we needed to build a very strong R&D capability because the name of the game going forward was incremental innovation, incremental in terms of top line growth and incremental in terms of pricing and profitability. And the only way to do that was to have a strong R&D department inside the company. We had very good people, but they were more development focused than they were R&D focused. On top of that, as we were shifting the portfolio to more good for you products, we realized that we needed products which had functionality claims. Whatever claims we made had to be rooted in science. They couldn't be flaky claims because when it comes to nutritious products in particular, people are very sensitive as to exactly what you say on the package because the ingredient list has to reflect, exactly what you're suggesting in the front of the product. I'll give you an example. When we bought Sobe, one of the Sobe products was called liquid liposuction. And that was Sobe Lean, liquid liposuction. You know, when Sobe was an edgy, small business, they could use these interesting words to describe their product. The minute PepsiCo bought it, liquid liposuction had to come off the bottle. And we had to explain what we meant by Sobe Lean in the back of the product. Because it's a big company, people hold us to a higher standard than they do, you know, small startups. So we needed a very, very good team that could be very serious about whatever we put on the package, on the label, on food safety, food security, food traceability.
Okay, on that note, your chief research scientist is an endocrinologist with an expertise in diabetes, yes?
I interviewed a lot of candidates, but I have to tell you, Mehmood Khan absolutely impressed me because here was somebody who came from a pharmaceutical background, a medical doctor, but was very interested in the whole food and beverage space and had an attitude, approach, and demeanor that I thought would fit very well within PepsiCo. So he didn't wear his medical credentials on his sleeve and sort of lecture to us as what we should and shouldn't be doing. He wasn't talking down to us. And he was so well networked and connected in the scientific world that I felt he could come into PepsiCo, build bridges within people in PepsiCo, further our scientific agenda, and bring the right talent into the company. And this is where the scientific background helped because I could understand what Mehmood was saying. And I could also challenge the R&D department to do things that, you know, they enjoyed doing. I mean, very often I'd write them a note saying, look, I have six challenges I'd like to give you. And this is why I'm putting these challenges out to you. And they loved it. You know, somebody else might say, God, she's wasting our time. But to the R&D people, wow, this is great that the CEO is interested. She wants to use us to move the company to a better place.
Give me a for instance of one of the kind of challenges you would have put to R&D.
One of the things I told them was that I wanted to take the waste from orange peels. You know, when you squeeze an orange, you have all of the peels and the flesh from the orange after you take out the juice that's converted to animal feed. I wanted to extract the fiber and figure out a way to put it back into the orange juice because orange juice doesn't have fiber, yet that orange pulp has so much of the fiber. How do you extract the fiber from that and put it into the juice? They've now accomplished that. And the list goes on and on.
I guess I have two things I'd love to know about the future of PepsiCo, one kind of specific and then one broader. The specific one is about working with non-traditional proteins, whether from insects or plants or fungi or whatnot. And then maybe related to that, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on personalized nutrition and where you see PepsiCo playing a role in that eventually.
Many of these areas are new emerging areas, Stephen. In some areas, they've progressed quite far. In other areas, on a mainstream basis, they're still new and emerging. Remember, there's a lot of startup companies in Silicon Valley that are playing around with personalized nutrition, playing with new sources of protein. They haven't yet come to the big companies and into the mainstream. We have bets that we are making with lots of little companies to think about personalized nutrition for athletes through Gatorade. We are working through other VCs to see how we can place bets on a group of companies working on non-traditional protein sources. The thing we have to be careful about is not trying to accelerate into the big leagues, something that's still on the edge and something that people are still getting comfortable with. So we are very judicious in making sure that, you know, when it comes to PepsiCo, it's ready to be scaled up. I mean, an example is Kevita. When we first invested in Kevita and kombucha, you know, it was still an emerging trend. But the way we structured the deal with Kevita, when we felt this was becoming a mainstream trend, we could buy it and scale it within the PepsiCo system.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, a different kind of partnership for Ingenui, the one that happens at home.
Because at the end of the day, your first priority is being sort of a wife and a mother and a daughter and a daughter-in-law and all those roles we have to play.
That's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Pepsi Cola was invented by a North Carolina pharmacist in the late 19th century. In the early 21st century, PepsiCo has more than 100 brands and trademarks, including 22 that each do more than $1 billion in annual sales. The company has a market cap of around $155 billion. We're speaking today with the CEO of PepsiCo, Ingenui. You are known for working hard, 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, I've read. I don't know if that's even possible. Is that true?
Close.
I'm just curious what you actually do in a given day, considering there is probably no given day in your job, but maybe today. Just give us a sense of what your work day is actually like.
Today, I woke up at 4 a.m. and I read the balance of the stuff I hadn't read over the weekend from my mail. And then I played tennis for an hour. Then I came to work at 8:30 this morning. And I go till about 10 o'clock tonight. I have back-to-back meetings. Then I go to the design studio this evening. I spend the evening with all the designers of PepsiCo. Then I take them to dinner, all of them. And over dinner, they get to ask me any questions they want on any topic. That'll probably last for 2 or 3 hours. And then I'll get home by about 10:30 or 11 tonight. I'll probably read whatever mail came from today till about midnight. Go to sleep and be back up at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And that's a normal routine.
Let me ask you, this is a standard question we ask a lot of people. I'm very curious to know how you'd answer it. What's something, Indranui, that you believed to be true for a long time until you found out that you were wrong?
Huh. I'm going to say something which you might actually chuckle about. For a long time, especially given my cultural upbringing, I thought, you know, you just listened to your parents and you did whatever they asked you to do until I had my own kids. And they told me, no, we are people too. We have our own mind. We do our own thing. And I learned the tough way that, you know, the rules that applied to me from my parents to me, I mean, I was a very dutiful kid in many ways. And if the parents said, jump over this line, you jumped over the line and you didn't ask questions. You know, as I had children here and my husband and I, we learned that they're people too. They have their own thoughts and ideas, and we have to jointly evolve a point of view as opposed to you will listen to me. So this is one of the, you know, in life, I'm learning a lot of lessons that are different from my own cultural upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Talk for a second about being a mother and a daughter to your mother, to your parents, and being CEO.
You know, I think we grew up in a culture where, you know, our parents basically said, don't let these jobs get to you, whatever your job is, because at the end of the day, your first priority is being sort of a wife and a mother and a daughter and a daughter-in-law and all those roles we have to play. So, you know, I have a mother who in particular believes that fiercely and believes that these jobs give you crowns and leave those crowns in the garage. When you come home, don't try to pretend that you're still the big boss because you're not.
Does that seem a little unfair? Because if you were born male, that she probably wouldn't say that to you?
That's correct. But, you know, I can't change her. So I can either spend my time trying to change her or just say, you know what, let her think whatever she wants. All the times that she's with me, I leave the crown in the garage. The rest of the time, I'd at least bring it and leave it on the front door or somewhere on a table instead of in the garage. You know something, Stephen? I think we all have to develop adaptation strategies. Because if we don't, we're going to start feeling resentful or angry with whatever's happening around us. From my perspective, my mom says, leave the crown in the garage. Fine, I left it in the garage. You know, I've been married 37 years to the same guy. I don't think I could have balanced all of this had I brought my crown into the house every day. There's no way it would have worked. And would I have liked to have brought it in? No, not at the expense of my marriage and my children. I'm married to a great guy, but it required constant sort of adjustments to make sure that we both were equal versus each other. And to our children, we both were parents. And one was not CEO and one is not CEO. I don't think that works at home at all.
Do you think that one reason there are relatively so few female CEOs in the States and elsewhere is that there's a kind of standard model for what we think of as a CEO, and that standard model is someone who never takes off the crown, not even at home? Is that an issue, do you think?
I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that we get a lot of women in the entry-level positions. You know, as you get to middle management, you know, women rise to those positions, and then that's the childbearing years. And when they have children, you know, it's difficult to balance having children, your career, your marriage, and, you know, be a high potential outperformer who's going to grown the company in an organization that's, you know, every one of them is a pyramid. So it starts to thin out as you move up. We have to solve for that. You know, I was lucky, Stephen, because I had a lot of extended family that all chipped in to help us take care of our kids. You know, my husband and I worked in partnership with each other to make sure that our schedules didn't keep us both out of the office at the same time. But then our families all chipped in to help take care of the kids, or supervise the nannies, if you want to call it that. And in turn, we take care of our aging parents today. And so I think this Asian model of having extended family coexist with the young people today may have to be imported in so that we can take care of our children and take care of the aging parents at the same time.
A few years ago, Nui was interviewed by David Bradley, chairman of The Atlantic at the Aspen Ideas Festival. She was asked whether women can indeed have it all, a career, family, etc.
And I'll tell you a story that happened when my daughter went to Catholic school, Convent of Sacred Heart. And every Wednesday morning, they have class coffee with mothers. Class coffee with mothers for a working woman. How is it going to work? How am I going to take off 9 o'clock on Wednesday mornings to go for a class coffee? So I miss most class coffees. My daughter would come home and she'd list off all the mothers that were there, and you were not their mom. First few times, I would die with guilt. But I developed coping mechanisms. I called the school and I said, give me a list of mothers who are not there. So when she came home, in the evening, she'd say, you were not there, you were not there. I said, uh-huh, Mrs. Rag wasn't there, you know, Mrs. So-and-so wasn't there. So I'm not the only bad mother. You know, you have to cope because you die with guilt. You just die with guilt. My observation, David, is that the biological clock and the career clock are in total conflict with each other. Total, complete conflict.
PepsiCo is the biggest company by market cap with a female CEO. So what kind of responsibility, if any, does that come with that isn't present for a male CEO?
I don't know about the market cap and the size of the company, but I will say that when you become a CEO and you're a woman, you are looked at differently. Whatever you say, people do say things like, well, you know, a guy CEO wouldn't have said that, or a guy would have said it differently. You are held to a different standard. There's no question about it. It's not that you've become CEO and now you get a hall pass. You don't. Everything you say, you do, gets analyzed a different way. Any industry, in any profession, in any part of society, trendsetters went through this sort of scrutiny and criticism and commentary. And so I think this group of women CEOs, all of us are going through that right now. Hopefully, as the numbers get bigger, and I hope they do, nobody's looking at us as women CEOs, but just as leaders of big enterprises. I hope that day comes sooner than later.
Coming up next time on Freakonomics Radio, we continue our conversation with Indra Nui of PepsiCo, and we hear from the CEOs past and present of Facebook, Microsoft, Reddit, Virgin, GE, and more, telling us all about the different kinds of crises they've had to handle, from consumer rebellions.
There were maybe 15 or 20,000 people who were very upset.
To changes in consumer preferences.
We tried too hard to keep our old model alive.
And huge changes in technology.
And then iTunes came along and the internet came along.
Don't forget macroeconomic problems.
The Japanese were coming. They were eating our lunch.
And good old-fashioned fraud.
And the guy called me and said, Jack, we've got $400 million missing.
Also, the joy of personnel issues.
How do you fire the one person who's actually going to get you over the finish line?
As Indra Nui told us today, when you are CEO, you are it. Next time, what being it really feels like.
Taking those decisions that impact people's lives and livelihood is not easy. It weighs very heavily on me personally.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.